that good hype for you?
My name's Steve, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
I couldn't help but think we already heard the three tenors today with Sandy and Scott and Chuck C. So we've been to the mountaintop and get down to sea level now because you're going to get the neurotic Jew from the streets of Beverly Hills. And that's the truth. But it is my story, and it does say somewhere that it's our most valuable asset. And from where, you know, I got to AA, zeroed out. There was absolutely, I was living a life that was no longer defensible even to myself. I mean, there was absolutely nothing working. And it's completely different today. And the only thing that's intervened between the day I got sober, August 10th, 1980, and today is Alcoholics Anonymous and a constant surrender and a submission and they're asking for help. And my life is the opposite of what it was then. I was appealed zero when I got here. And it's filled. It's filled with friends. I was emptied out. I did not go I didn't answer the phone. The drapes were drawn. I didn't go to the mailbox. I was sitting in a yellow rocking chair for the last 3 years drinking cheap scotch and thinking about me. And that kept me very busy. So I'm going to tell you my story in chronological order. I'm the youngest of three kids, a native Californian. My mother married this man. In those days, you got married to get out of the house. Love was not often involved. It wasn't involved in that particular relationship. He was attractive, and she didn't get along with her mother, and they got married. And the first piece of furniture they bought for the house, he bought, was a bar. Now, that's not one of the 20 questions, but it could be, you know. If you bought a bar before you bought your children a bed, go to AA now. And that was my dad, and they were married until I was about 4 years old, and she met someone who was going to upgrade the family, and it was going to be an upgrade. And they didn't sit the three little kids down and say, I'm divorcing this man, I'm going to marry this man. My family communicates in eye signals and hand signals. And it was, shh, he's got money, camp, restaurants, shh. A lot of this. And they threw us in the house, three kids, and he had three kids, and all of a sudden there's six of us. Or eight of us in this little house, and the message that was communicated to me is be quiet and calm down. Now I got to tell you, I was not a calm kid. I was give you some of my outward symptoms. I was a fingernail biter, a bedwetter, a teeth grinder, a pencil eater, and a foot wiggler. You know. You see that name? I've been watching Sandy. Whenever Sandy talks, he's a foot swinger. You know. If you want a name for that, it's called idling. A lot of alcoholics idle. They're constantly. And that was me. You know, in first grade, I was the kid. They loved me. They just often put my desk in the hallway because I also was being given an upper GI for ulcers at the age of 9. So I was a nervous little guy. And if you see a kid like that, give him a drink, you know. Here, little boy, have a beer, have a case, you know, you need it. And I needed a drink. I needed a drink. I didn't get a drink until I was 14. And it was a long 14 years of just wiggling and squirming and looking at you, and you look like you have the roadmap and I'm lost. You look comfortable and I'm uncomfortable. You look like you're having conversations with people and I'm tongue-tied and I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. The only time as a kid I was comfortable was playing baseball. Just felt like I belonged on a baseball field, and I was really good up until the age of 12. I was the pitcher. I got all my self-esteem from being a little ball player. I was the pitcher and the shortstop, and everyone, oh, you're the great little ball player. And at the age of 13, you go up to Little League, and all of a sudden they throw the ball faster, and all of a sudden I got afraid of getting hit by the ball. And you can't hide the fear. I can hide the other fear. I can hide the fear of people by being funny or moving around or disappearing. But when the batter's afraid, you have to step towards the pitcher to hit the ball, and I'm stepping towards my mommy. And it's not macho. And rather than go to a coach and ask for help, I pick a fight with him and quit the team. I'm going to give up the thing I love the most rather than ask for help. And I brought that deep into sobriety. And I gave up. I quit the team, and I gave it up right away. And at that same time, we were living in this town. We were the only Jewish family in this town. And I always felt too Jewish. I wanted to be just like the other kids and sing the Christmas carols. And then we moved to Beverly Hills, where it's 90% Jewish. And my first day of school, I'm thinking, I'm just not Jewish enough to cut it in Beverly Hills. They all seem so Jewish, you know? And they also seem so disinterested in the newcomer in town. They treated me disdainfully. They hardly even looked at me for weeks. I couldn't make a friend, and I hook up with this other guy who had just moved to town, Greg, and so the two out-of-towners are hanging out, and one night he says, hey, there's a club up on Sunset Boulevard. You want to go? I said, okay, and we went up. We took the bus. We went in, and they were disinterested in both of us, and it was uncomfortable, and I didn't make a friend, and we gave up. I said, let's go, and a week later he says, you want to go back? And I said, I don't think so, and he said, I have a quart of Smirnoff, and I said, I'll be right down. And I was growing up in a house without alcohol, but the father, who my mother divorced, would have us every couple weeks, and he would have that bar with all the booze, and I was just drawn to it like a moth to a fly. I just fell in love with all the glasses and the bottles and the labels and stuff. So when Greg says Smirnoff vodka, I take the walk two blocks down to his house, and we pour the quart of Smirnoff and a quart of orange juice and stir it around, put a little Galliano on top, start drinking. And I sighed for the first time in 14 years. You know, I just went, oh. You know, that way you have a pain, and all of a sudden you get so used to living with the pain that all of a sudden it's gone. You go, oh, my God, this is wonderful. Oh, and we got on the bus. We took the bus again back up to the Sunset Strip. We were the only two people on the bus and lost each other on the way there. And I walked into the club that night alone. And it seemed like, and Sandy tells the story when the first time he spoke and walking into Yale into that party, he felt that's my story walking into the club that night. It seems like I walked in and they all turned around and were interested in me. And it changed my world. I made friends. Girls didn't scare me. I was a guy among guys. We were hanging out. And just, I abandoned myself to alcohol. It just became the most important thing in the world to me, and I didn't know it until I got sober. Every decision I was going to make socially and in my life was about getting enough supply of booze. Where are we going? Oh, okay, we're going to be at Nancy's house Friday night. I'm in charge of getting enough booze. You know, God forbid an Al-Anon is ordering the booze. You know, it's a scary thought. They could run out and not even know it. God. So I would order. I'd call up the liquor store, Gil Turner's, 213-651-2000 is their number. You bring it on, you know, bring it on. Come on, double. How much? We got 30 kids? Double. All right. And we didn't run out, and that was my whole thing. I don't want to run out. I always got to get done. I need to relax, and I can't relax unless we have a lot. And so I drank my way through high school. I stopped doing well in school. Some people do really well in school. I didn't. I smoked a little pot in high school. I gave that up. I was really and I'll apologize right away. I'm a kid of the 60s, and I did very few drugs. I'm very sorry. I smoked a little pot. My memories are, it's not good for paranoid people. You know, that was it. And also, it's like, don't look at me, give me your cheeseburger, you know, or I'll kill you, something like that. Anyway, I go through high school, I'm the teenage drunk, I had alcohol poisoning at 16 years old from drinking a quart of scotch and mixing it with water, and I remember solemn oath, and I couldn't stop vomiting liver bile and just going, Never. I will never, ever do this again. Please, God, help me. And the family doctor. And by 5 o'clock the next day, going, I think you shouldn't put water in scotch. The water really makes you sick. And I drank the next day, you know, because anything to make me sigh or give me relief, I'm going to do it. And I drank my way. I graduated high school in the lower sixth of my graduating class. I was sent to a... It's not that funny. There was a college. They're still there. It was the last year. It was an all-guy college up in San Francisco, and it was small classes. And it was an opportunity for kids to get back on track who screwed around in high school. And I was sent there. It was 400 students and 12 kids and wonderful professors. And they had put me in trailers behind the campus. They seemed to have pre-qualified all the alcoholics. And they had a big 5-gallon water thing in the dorm room. And we immediately emptied out the water, went to the liquor store across the street and got 5 gallons of vodka. And it's like, I'm ready for school. And drinking. Now it's not the weekends. It's I can drink and I can calm down. The other thing that happened is my buddy Joey went up there. And Joey was a hyperactive kid like I was, but his parents had taken him to a psychiatrist who prescribed this pill that was supposed to calm him down called Dexamil. And Dexamil is, it's magnificent. And Joey acted calm enough to keep the supply going. Let me just put it that way. Dexamil increases your vocabulary by 36,000 words. And you use them all in like the first 10 minutes. So and if you're a smoker, you don't need matches because you're absolutely never without a cigarette. You're just lighting one. And that, I realized my potential, and that became an obsession for the next 10 years. I was a little speed freak, scotch drinking, vodka drinking student. But when I don't have something in me, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. It doesn't feel right. I'm ill at ease, and I blame people, places, and things for my internal world. It's you. The campus is too small. There's no girls here. I need to get out of here. If I go somewhere else, then I'll fit somewhere else. I just don't fit here. And I fantasize. I'm a wonderful world-class fantasizer. In those days, they didn't have computers, but they had college catalogs. I would go in the library and I'd pull it off the shelf. Maybe I should go to Maine. Maybe I should drink Mai Tais in Hawaii. And I stumble across a college and it's on a ship and it travels around the world. And I thought, there's my school. Did a little research. I heard 300 girls and 100 guys. And I thought, even a shy kid could get laid on this trip. And I apply and they took me. It's not Harvard Medical School. If you apply, you get taken. And I called home. I said, can I go? And my mom said, yeah, you can go. And I realized now what a privilege it was to be able to do something like that. And I wish I remembered it, quite frankly. all the kids, we sailed from New York to London, and everyone went off to museums. And I found Peter, and we drank at the pub in the harbor. I mean, and then it was just, how do we smuggle on enough booze? Because we're going to Amsterdam. He goes, you know, and get it in the cabin, to get the booze, to get the courage in me to leave my cabin, to go out and do what other students seem to be doing naturally. I can't function around people unless there's alcohol in me. I cannot. I'm too uptight. And I drank my way around the world. I have a lot of pictures and no memories. And fortunately, my parents had never been there, so I could do a slideshow and just make up stuff when I came back to make them feel fulfilled. And came back and went to a 4-year college. I graduated college in 4 years. I went to USC only because I didn't know you could make it last for 10 till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear people here, yeah, I was in college for 20 years. And I always go, what was my hurry? You know, I was in no hurry at all. And when you're a senior in college, people start looking. Well, my stepfather mainly was looking at me like, move out, get a job, do something, go away. They were very tired of all these 6 kids, and I was the last remnant there. So I applied to law school because I didn't want to get a job. And all of a sudden, I apply to one law school, and they take me. And I'm like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now because my dirty little secret is I'm not very smart. And I don't have what it takes. And all of a sudden, I'm in law school, and I'm sitting, and I'm always, I am the best student for the first 2 weeks of a semester. I am the outlining, yellow, green, little notes, everything's readable. And the first day of class, I remember it was a contracts class, and it was a case, Hamer versus Sidway, a contracts case, consideration. And I'm prepared. And he calls my name Abrams. Alphabetically, I'm screwed, you know. And he tries to have this Socratic method with me where he's trying to draw out the issues of the case. And I'm standing up in front of 150 students. And I have a panic attack in front of the class. And if you've never had a panic attack, they're really just wimpy. I mean, I think only women should have them, but you're sweating, your heart's pounding, your brain's worrying, your mouth is dry, and he's trying to engage me in a little conversation. I'm being publicly humiliated. And I didn't know till years later that what he got, until I wrote an inventory, that who he got that day was the 12-year-old kid in the batter's box. That's what he got. Because every time I had an emotion, I poured alcohol on top of it. I never went and got help. And the very first day of law school, I'm being embarrassed in front of everyone. And once again, rather than go to the professor after class and ask for help, I go to the bar and pour alcohol on top of it because alcohol will get rid of it. And I spent 2 years in law school just hiding and laying low and moving along. And I had 5 amphetamine doctors, so I'm somewhere in the middle of class. I'm a little edgy, but I'm motivated, you know. Speed is speed's okay unless a bird's shadow flies over you. And you absolutely can come out of your skin. What was that? So I was a little jumpy. And I go through 2 years of law school. And I'm like, I'm screwed. People think I'm going to be a lawyer. And I'm not. They're not smart enough to pass the bar. And I don't really want to be a lawyer. And they think I do. And all of a sudden, it was like an angel flew into my life. And this guy appears and says, you know, I have this business in Chicago, and my son died, and you're the one I'd like to turn it over to, and if you come and work for me, you'll be a millionaire by the time you're 30, and I'll give you a new Corvette. I'm like, okay, I'm there. I'm taking a leave of absence from law school, and off I go to Chicago, and I entered the second phase of my alcoholism. It was the fun phase, and it was taking away the fear in the early days, and I went there, and sometimes it would do that, and sometimes it wouldn't. And sometimes it would be a stimulant, and sometimes I'd get depressed. And I was afraid of customers, and he had mentioned that I drank, and he didn't want me breathing on the customers. So I was hiding from the customers. I didn't sell a car in like 2 months, and I got arrested for drunk driving. And it started to fall off the edge of the earth. And the other significant thing that happened to me there is one drunken night we were talking, and he had said to me, you know, your mother and I were very close about 9 months before you were born. And I took that information like I take information. I don't go and say help or talk to me or whatever. I pour alcohol on top of it. And I came back to L.A., the day of my drunk driving trial, re-enrolled in law school and tried to finish law school and didn't. I mean, I would at this point, my drinking had gotten to the point where I was I had a bottle between my legs driving down Wilshire Boulevard to go to school and would pull into the parking lot and I'd get another drink to get the courage to leave the car to go in the class to sit there. And I got within 2 classes of graduating law school. And didn't show up for an exam, and they flunked me out. I had already been fingerprinted to take the bar and measured for cap and gown for the graduation service. And at this time, my family was my stepfather was the patriarch and the glue that held us together. And my brother was at that time in the midst of what was about a 20-year heroin run. And my mom, who really didn't drink until I was in high school, was drinking. And that stepfather went off one night to play racquetball and had a heart attack and dropped dead. And the family just fell apart. And now I'm back from Chicago and I'm drinking alcoholically and my mom's drinking a half gallon of vodka a day and the brother is burglarizing the house on a regular basis. And it was all the fun and laughter that that man had brought to the family was now gone. And as long as I was in law school, too, the heat was off. Law school will keep people back from you. You're a loser, you're selfish, you're an asshole, but you're going to be a lawyer. When you flunk out of law school, you're not going to be a lawyer anymore. You're the guy who flunked out of law school, and your covers are pulled. And my mom had felt guilty, and she was throwing money at us kids. And so I was living in this nice apartment and dying of alcoholism and cutting things off and not going to the mailbox. And I finally had a girlfriend leave me and say, you drink too much. Now I have the drunk driving, the guy in Chicago, the girlfriend's leaving. I said, oh, you know what, I'll go to AA. And I called and I went over to a meeting house about two blocks from where I live. And I sat against the wall and felt like the biggest loser you could possibly be in the whole world. I wanted to be like my stepfather told me. I wanted to have the willpower to have two or three drinks and just quit. And I wasn't done. And the speaker said something. He drank mouthwash because he was out of booze for the alcohol. And I thought, well, if I ever drink Scope, I'll come back to you guys. You know, I'm a Scotch drinker, not a Scope drinker. And those last, I really sat in that yellow rocking chair just dying, just thinking somewhere along the line, I have to figure it out, that I have to think my way into sobriety. And how I finally got sober was a buddy fixed me up on a date with a girl. It was a weird thing. It was totally a God shot for me, because let's just say I wasn't a good catch. Without getting too specific. And I said yes to go out with this girl, and she was cute and adorable and successful, which meant I can't ask her out again because she composes music for film and television. What if she says, what do you do? I drink. That's it? No, I watch Jeopardy. I drink. I watch Jeopardy. That's it? I think about myself a lot, you know. How's your score coming, you know? And so I didn't ask her out for a couple weeks, but apparently I called her in a blackout. And I told her stuff that I'd hidden from everyone who cared about me, you know, about my drinking, and then I was dying of I won't have a life as long as I drink. And she said, well, I'm in OA, and if you'd like, I'll take you to an AA meeting. And I said, okay. And she called me the next day thinking I may unsurrender myself. And she took me to Sunday Noon, Ohio Street, August 10th, 1980. And I walked in there, and I sat in the front and melted. The biggest charge then, it's really the same charge today, is you talked and I went, me too. I did that. I'm like you. You drank worse than me, not as bad as me. You took more pills than me, a little less than me. And you were clearly happy about being sober. It just melted me. And especially talking about the feelings better than and less than simultaneously. Feeling separated by a pane of glass from everyone else. Wanting this self-consciousness, this self-obsession. I was just me too, this is my tribe and I belong here. And I took the first half of the first step that night. I have been trying to control and enjoy my drinking now for 5 years, and every day I just kind of poop out and lose interest in the project. Oh, alcohol's the problem. I just won't drink. And the obsession was taken away, and then my life will get manageable. And I did not 12-step my mother, but she followed me in here. She was and got in the Pacific group, and she got a sponsor, and one of the first things her sponsor told her was to stop giving me money. So I thought, well, sponsors really get involved in shit that's none of their goddamn business. What the hell's that got to do with me drinking, you know? I'll just starve to death. And I had this little obsession with this woman. You know, and I thought I would go into enough meetings to know that sometimes sponsors intervene in stuff like that, and I didn't want anyone intervening with this sober sex I was having. And so I went a long time without a home group, a sponsor, or working a step, and I got the results of no recovery. And on my second, that girl got pregnant, by the way, and we didn't get along when we were in a vertical position at all. You know, it was one of those, I hate your guts, lie down, I love you relationships. And she got pregnant, and on my second AA birthday, we went to Cedars-Sinai, and my son Max was born. And we weren't going to get married, and we hardly talked, and her family was very angry with me. And I was scared to death, and I was probably as close to drinking as I hope I ever get. And I wasn't even thinking of drinking, but I had that knot in my chest that only scotch dissolves, you know. And they were angry with me, and I understand. And I was scared to death. I was hardly working. Let's just say I had an indoor job, and I had a good tan. It was a scary time, and her parents came to town, and they didn't want me to take the baby outside because he hadn't been baptized, that he could end up in limbo for a billion years or something. Didn't they just do away with that? Well, in 1982, limbo was going strong, trust me. So I wanted to get Max Abrams out of the house, you know, to get him a little fresh air, and I'm telling him, and the local priest wouldn't do it. Because our relationship was unresolved, and I was telling my mom this story, and she's like, you're going to drink, you need to go to meetings. I said, I need to baptize this kid. And she's like, oh, it's so funny, I heard this Catholic priest last night at a meeting. Let me give his number, and you can call him and maybe manipulate him into doing it. And great, the Jews are on the case, we're good at this shit. So I call this guy up. Oh, yeah, you're an alcoholic? Yeah, I am. He says, well, meet me at a meeting and we'll talk after. It's always the same with this guy. Let's go to a meeting first and we'll talk after. And they had moved the meeting outside and into a courtyard, and there was just a light on him. And I thought, oh, I could relax in this meeting. They won't call on me. I could just sit here. And he shared in a Buddhist expression, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher appears. And it was the most important night, I think, of my whole life, because I always get tears when I talk about it. Because I walked up and said, help, help, I'm lost. My life is clearly unmanageable. I need direction. I need help. I need a sponsor. And he's been my sponsor now for 25 years and is absolutely the most important relationship in my life. I was thinking today we were talking about fathers came up a lot tonight. It was tonight I was thinking about it. All my life I had the first father who I was embarrassed that he was an alcoholic, and the stepfather who always said in my house that blood is thicker than water, and I knew what that meant. And then I had the guy in Chicago who told me he's probably my father, and I was to find out that he was my father years later. And then I had this priest, Father Terry, as my sponsor. And ultimately, we talked today. It's our father. You know, it's been this search my whole life for the father. And that's the father. You know, that's the path I've been on. And that's what Terry's always, my sponsor's always telling me. You know, the good sponsor, do the work. There's your answer. Do the work. But that's the answer. So the last 25 years has been a slow walk to the center of the program. A slow walk to the center of the program. I haven't had this exquisite life. Exquisite. It was very hard for me to make friends and be around people for many years in sobriety. I got the not drinking part. I just couldn't be comfortable around people, even in AA and meetings. And it's been a slow journey to relax here. And the fellowship has grown up around me. Boy, I got the most wonderful people in my life. Just extraordinary. I was hopeless when I got here. You know, I think I was in good shape. I had very low expectations, and it served me well. My life is absolutely huge today, and I want it all. I want it big. I want the big horizon. It seems to me, the image I get of me without AA is Steve's normal position is this, with my chin on my chest and thinking about me, you know, and worrying about me and what's going to go wrong in my life and where the snake is going to come out of the bushes and bite my leg. What psychiatrist once told me, you have the worst case of catastrophic thinking I've ever seen in my 32 years of practice. I thought, can I turn this into a business, you know, where someone could call me and go, Exxon and Texaco are going to merge. What's the bad things that could happen, Steve? And I go, oh, boom, 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 boom. You know. So that's me in my normal state. Self-obsessed and fearful and worried. And the more I surrender to you and God and hang around with you, that the program seems to lift my chin up to the horizon to show me what my higher power has been sending me all along, and I'm missing because I'm in the bondage of self. So to slowly uncover, discover, and discard, uncover, discover, and discard, I'm a work in progress, but it's the best it's ever been. I just love AA. Thanks.
Steve, thank you. Steve and I have something in common. We went to lunch with Clancy at the mission. I'm not going to say anything except when we finished, we both looked at each other and said, I'm going to pretend I never saw that. Anyway. That was just wonderful. And now I get the pleasure of introducing another great man from Hagerstown, Maryland, Jack Kortman. Come on up, Jack.
Thank you, Sandy. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Jack.
What a... privilege it is to attend this weekend, and what an honor it is to be asked to participate in it. And I really do. I think all of us do have to thank God for allowing Sandy to be open to an intuitive thought to do something like this, and to Sandy to be willing to. Organize it. And I want to thank folks who I'd never really met before, Amy and Guy and Chris, and now I had met Dave before, who have been willing to suit up and show up and do the grunt work because this stuff just doesn't happen. I just can't imagine the registration involved with dealing with all these egos who, you know, want it just so. And what a miracle. I want to thank Scott and Steve for participating. And what a treat it was to see that tape with Chuck. And then for all you guys who shared around the fire ring tonight, and I just can't imagine what was going through your minds as Dave would go over and put another log on it and the sparks would blow your way and you said, that son of a bitch is going to put another log on the fire. But Dave's got nothing to do with the way the wind blows. So now there were a couple of us who were not as sick as others, and they got up and moved. And that some of us sat with our backs to the prevailing wind, and that seemed to work well. I'm from Hagerstown, Maryland. I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the third oldest group in the state of Maryland. I'm not sure about this, but I think I can probably say this without fear of contradiction. The Hagerstown group has four members here at this weekend. So we may be the most well-represented group, at least outside of the Tampa area. We meet on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and if we were in Hagerstown, we would be at our home group tonight, because that's what we do when we're in Hagerstown. And I like to say that I am a member in good standing of that group. By that I mean I have a sponsor, My sponsor has a sponsor. I sponsor people. I attend my home group when they meet, if I'm in town. I have a service position, and I think all of that is real important to be a member in good standing in Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't always that way for me. This is a pretty unique weekend and a pretty interesting gathering of people. If I might inquire the number of folks who are here by a show of hands who are in your first year of sobriety. First year. We got two. Okay. Yeah, been an interesting year, hadn't it? Yeah. Well, it'll get better. I think that being with so many people who have got more than a year's sobriety can be daunting. Because a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And I was thinking, actually I wasn't thinking because that scares my sponsor, but I was reflecting about what an exciting week it is for us. Just this past Tuesday, December 11th, 1934, Bill took his last drink and my life was saved. Imagine that. An event that took place long before I was born, destined to save my life. And it almost passed without my noticing it. And maybe it passed without your noticing it. You know, there's just something absolutely miraculous about the history and lore of Alcoholics Anonymous that just touches my heart. I don't know about yours, but my mom's 92 years old, and she lives on her own, and she was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, and she knows what an alcoholic is. And when I told her that I was coming down here for this weekend, she said, are you going to be speaking down there? And I said, I may. And she said, well, if you speak down there, you make sure that you tell those people that you are not an alcoholic. So I've told you. Like I said, my mom was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, and she knows what an alcoholic is. And I just think, what would have happened at any time in my mom's life if she'd have gotten a telephone call on a Saturday before Mother's Day and the guy on the phone said, hey, I'm a rummy from New York and I'm looking for a drunk to work with. Can you help me? My mother would have hung up. She wouldn't have taken that call. And here is Henrietta Cyberly living in that gatehouse, separated from her husband. What a disgrace. What a shameful thing in 1935. Separated from her husband, living on the property of her in-laws in the gatehouse. And Henrietta had prayed for her friend, Dr. Bob, and she had prayed that God would send somebody to help her friend. Please, God, send somebody to help Dr. Bob. So she was expectant. She was expectant that her prayer would be answered. And so when the phone rang and the guy says, I'm a rummy from New York, she said, come on out. Come on out. Can you imagine the social stigma for a separated woman in 1935 to have a rummy from New York come visit in her house to be a guest with she and her children? Disgraceful. She didn't hesitate. And of course, we all know that Bob came on Mother's Day and going to stay 15 minutes, no longer. That's it. And 5.5 hours later, the spark had been struck. Now, Dr. Bob, like me, really wasn't interested in the program of action that had been offered to him by Bill. Seemed pretty demanding. Required a lot of things Dr. Bob didn't think were going to work, but obviously this guy seemed to know what he was talking about, so let's hang out together and live on fear and fellowship and see how that works out. And so they did. And like happens to so many of us, sometimes we get a little bit sober, we want to start working out at the gym, maybe go back to school. Dr. Bob had to go to a medical association meeting all of a sudden, and so off he went, and he got snot flying drunk, and they poured him off the train, and Bill went and got him and tried to sober him up. And Dr. Bob's a medical man, you know, and I'm sure most of you know, but in case you don't know, he was a specialist. And I don't know what proctology is today, what it was then, but I think proctology is pretty much the same. You just deal with a lot of assholes, and Dr. Bob had one to deal with, and he had to do the operation. He had to do the operation. I mean, I guess he'd probably been paid in advance. I don't know. So they drove him down to the hospital and gave him a beer to steady his hand. Wonder what that guy's name was. Yeah. Did you ever think about that? You know, his name's been lost to AA history. I mean, he offered himself up as a human sacrifice. Proctologist with a shaky hand. Makes me nervous. I don't know about you. And Dr. Bob never drank again. Never drank again. And then, you know, just was it, what was that, June 10th, I think it was? And then we read in our literature, this guy, Bill D., he's June 26th, he's in the hospital, and these guys come see him. I mean, that's like 16 days. So how long do you have to be in Alcoholics Anonymous before you start sponsoring people? Sounds like 16 days. It's in the book. You know, I mean, Bill was out there pulling guys off bar stools from December 11th to Mother's Day and hadn't worked for anybody, but he stayed sober. Intensive work with other alcoholics, I think is what is being offered here. But just amazing when I reflect upon it. Sandy said that I had time, I forget how much time he said, but it was two and a half hours, so he said we'll finish late, so whatever it is. But he said I could talk about my favorite subject, and I was going to talk about Steve, but he already talked about him, so I'm going to talk about me. Surprised, aren't you? I may not be much, but I'm all I think about, and I think about me a lot. At least I did before I started taking action on this program. I think alcohol did for me, certainly what it did for Steve. I'm sure it probably did for me what it did for you. I mean, for people who don't have this problem, you know, they drink, they get drunk, they make an ass out of themselves, they get in a fight, they get shit beat out of them, they get up the next morning, and they don't do that again. I understand that for many of us, that's a definition of fun. And I didn't get in a lot of fights. I could start a lot of fights because I had bigger guys with me who were good at fighting, but I was just good at starting fights. So I didn't get beat up. But and then, of course, part of that was I'd worked as a police officer, so I had a gun, and that generally discourages a lot of fighting. But it was when I was a police officer that I found out that, I was a college kid, and I mean, like most college kids, I think I had no idea what I wanted to do when college was over. I was majoring in drinking pretty much, and working as a cop, and I stopped this guy for drunk driving, and I gave him a ticket. He was obviously drunk. He said, "You don't know who I am, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I'm the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." Like I said, I'm a college kid. I don't have the slightest idea what a state's attorney does. Never heard of one, never saw one, don't know what they do. So I said, "Good for you. Sign the ticket." And he did, and there was a sober guy there, and I let him drive away. And into my shift, I pulled into the parking lot at the police department, and 8 o'clock in the morning, there was the chief of police. He said, "Come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." These were the first words the chief had spoken to me the whole summer. I thought, this is a good thing that's going to happen here. This is going to get some recognition, long overdue recognition for a job well done. And I went up there and, you know, and walked into the office, and much to my surprise, when I walked into the chief's office, there Seated on the couch right inside the door was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. And they said, give me that ticket book. And I handed the ticket book to him, and he opened it up to the ticket for the guy and handed it to the guy. And that guy pulls out a pen and writes across the face of the ticket, case dismissed, and signs his name. And it was at that moment that I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could be one of those state's attorneys, man, I definitely wanted to be one of them, because if you can dismiss traffic charges with a stroke of a pen, if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, come in real handy. So I went to law school, and I met my wife while I was in college, where I met the girl that I was going to marry, and she and I... We went out on a blind date and fraternity party, and she drank with me drink for drink. I mean to tell you, we had a wonderful time. And I took her back to her sorority, and she went in, and I realized that this is the first woman I've ever dated who did not throw up in my car. I'm going to marry this girl. And so when I was in law school, we got married. And we had a wonderful time drinking together. And then we started having children. And when she got pregnant, she quit drinking. And she hasn't drank since. What the hell is that all about? Lost my drinking buddy. When I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. And then after I stopped drinking, we were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. And I think that's a pretty clear indication that drinking has nothing to do with any of those six separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six of them, and we didn't know. So I got out of law school, and I went back to Hagerstown, and I became a deputy state's attorney. And then I had a chance to become state's attorney, but the local senator screwed it up. And so some of us were having some drinks, and we said somebody ought to do something to that state senator. He shouldn't be allowed to get away with it. And somebody ought to run for the state senate, so I ran for the state senate. And the senator ran off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee and abandoned his wife and children, and I got elected to the state senate. And when you get elected to the Senate in Maryland, they give you a license plate that says state senator, and that's an aid to efficient law enforcement, because that way they don't have to pull you over. At least back then, they would just turn those overheads off once they got close enough to see that license plate, and they'd pull up alongside you on the interstate, and they'd turn that interior dome light on, and they'd toot the horn, beep, beep, aye, Senator, aye, Trooper, hold it down, Senator, okay, Trooper. And that way, you know, I could go on my way without being interfered with, and they didn't have to waste a lot of time with members of the General Assembly. So, you know, we got a situation in our town where we had a vacancy on the circuit court, general jurisdiction trial judge, and I went to see the governor about getting my friend appointed, and he said he wouldn't appoint him, but it's a 15-year term, and we only had two judges, and so it doesn't come around that very often. And he said he wouldn't appoint my friend, but if I wanted to be a circuit court judge, he'd appoint me circuit court judge, so I became a circuit court judge. That was 30 years ago. And drinking alcoholically and not knowing that there's a problem, because I've not been arrested. I've never been arrested, never lost a job, you know. Never been to jail, never been to prison, never been divorced, don't have any illegitimate children, kids born out of wedlock. I don't even have a good tattoo. It's obvious I'm not alcoholic. And I got real sick one year, April 7th, 1982, and I was in the hospital for 7 weeks, and they said I was going to die, but I didn't. And so, my kidneys had quit, and my liver was out of whack, and my pancreas was digesting itself, and my respiratory system quit, but I was hanging in there. And eventually, my kidneys started. I got off the respirator, and then I got off the dialysis stuff, and my liver came back, and pancreas started, stopped digesting itself. So they said they'd send me home. And when you're in the hospital for like 7 weeks like that, they ask you, or they talk to you about what not to do so you don't get it again. But my illness was undiagnosed, so I don't know what to tell you. But they did say that they didn't want me to drink. And I said, well, how long? And they said, a year. And I was getting, it was May 28th. And I said, well, I haven't had anything to drink since April the 7th. This is the 28th of May. I think I can do that. Okay. And they said, no, Judge, you don't understand. You're very fine doctors at Johns Hopkins. They said, you don't understand. It's Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink from June the 1st. Now, I know that there are people in this room already who are discerning the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me. Because I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. And I want you to know that I fought for those 7 weeks, and an argument broke out between those learned physicians and this knuckleheaded judge. And we reached a compromise. And the compromise was that I wouldn't drink till next April the 7th. And then if I thought that the pain and suffering and misery which I had just endured had anything to do with drinking, then I would not drink till June the 1st. It was up to me. And so I walked out of Johns Hopkins Hospital not drinking. Nobody said anything about alcoholism. They said, don't drink. Give your kidneys a rest. Allow your liver to recover, your pancreas. Alcohol just knocks the heck out of those things. Don't drink. Love life. Have a good time. Well, I now know, and I think a lot of you know, if not all of us know, that when separated from alcohol, the doctor says, in his opinion, that we become restless, irritable, and discontent. That's an understatement in my case. I was pissed off in a spring-loaded position is what I was, and I'd be happy to share that with you if you happen to step in front of me or happen to have your DWI case on Monday morning. But so there it is. I'm not drinking and not changing and just praise her in a March hare. Just the insanity of it all. Drinking was not an option for me. Our literature seems to indicate that we hang on as best we can. And then if we can't hang on any longer, we'll pick up a drink, slow suicide. Or for some of us who recognize that drinking is not an option, then we pick up a gun. Or we run into a bridge abutment or go out a window. Fast suicide. That's it for people like me. There's no door number three. Either learn how to live by spiritual principles or hang on as best you can to the bitter end, Jack. And our sheriff had shot himself to death in the basement of our courthouse, and my office was on the top floor, and I thought, well, if I shot myself in my office, that would add symmetry to the building. It would even things out. Now, I need to say that I was talking, when I talk to people who aren't alcoholics about fighting for those 7 weeks of continuous sobriety that they were trying to steal away from me, people who aren't alcoholics, they don't laugh. They look at me like I'm crazy. And, of course, I am crazy. That's part of the reason why Sandy asked me to share a little bit tonight because I'm crazy, and he knows I'm crazy. And of course, that calls into question your sanity because you're sitting here listening with rapt attention. But I digress. Oh, man, this is an exciting time for me. Next Saturday, December 22nd, 18 years ago, I'm not drinking, I'm not changing. My wife and I are separated yet again. I got a girlfriend. I got a backup girlfriend just in case the girlfriend finds out what I'm really like. I got a girlfriend for special occasions. I think some of you know what that's about. I'm covered. I got my bases covered. I got an apartment. And two guys, Ken and Bob, had concluded that I was dying of untreated alcoholism. And Bob had come to me. My dad eventually came to AA. And when he passed away, he had 15 years of continuous sobriety. And Bob said, you know, we got this book in AA. We call it the Big Book. And I thought maybe you'd be interested in reading it, find out about your dad's illness. Well, clever guy, that Bob. And if he'd have said anything remotely close to, we think you ought to read it so you could find out what's wrong with you, there's nothing wrong with me. And I'm definitely not alcoholic because I'm not drinking. And we all know alcoholics have to drink. I may be a little bit on edge, all right? Just a little prickly, but you know what? If you just mind your own damn business, all right? Leave me the heck alone. Just go do something else, all right? Just stop it, would you? I'll be fine. Everything's fine here. That summer, I'd left the psychiatrist's office in June, and he had said I was coping very well and that maybe I should just take the summer off. And if I wanted to come back in September, I could. And I left his office wondering whether I should shoot myself that day. Now, I didn't tell him that. I mean, come on. I mean, he's a psychiatrist. If he's any good, he'd know. And I'm not going to give it up, man, you know. You don't just go pay those guys a couple $100 an hour and then give it to them. They got to work for it. And so I was coping very well. And so I'd read that book, and yeah, my dad's in there, and much to my surprise, of course, I was in there, and I was willing to concede to Bob and contend that there was a possibility, remote possibility, slight possibility, if you would, that I may have contracted a very mild case of alcoholism. Caught it just in time, and that was enough for Ken and for Bob. They came to my chambers, my judge's office, every Friday after that at lunchtime, and they brought a brown bag lunch and their big books, and we would read the big book together, and they would explain to me the importance of what we'd read, and I would explain to them as Jack saw it. And as you can imagine, we had many very fine, intellectual, high-level conversations there. And I explained to Ken and to Bob that while I had had some problems in high school, I'll acknowledge that. I was 5 years in high school. Yeah, Steve, yeah, 5 years in high school. I, however, also graduated college in 4 years. And I graduated law school in 3 years, with honors, I might add. So there, you need to know who you're dealing with. And Ken said, we got degrees on rectal thermometers, Jack, and you know what we do with those. I thought that was rude. So on the 22nd of December of 89, it was a Friday, and the courthouse was closed, so we couldn't have our big book thing, so we went to lunch, and after lunch, I went back to my apartment, and there was a Hickory Farms package propped against my door, and mailman had brought up three flights of steps. I got a cheese log here, I think, maybe, or maybe a sausage, you know. Somebody sent the judge a sausage. That's nice. And I went into my apartment and taking messages off the answering machine and trying to figure out how to open this Hickory Farms box. And I had plans for that night. My girlfriend and I, we were going out, and then we had plans for Saturday and then Christmas Eve, and plans for Christmas and plans for New Year's and plans into 1990. And I figured out, I cut the tape on this box, and I'm listening to the messages, and I lifted the lid of the box. Boom! And I got blown back against the wall. And a federal appellate judge had been killed 10 days before in Birmingham, Alabama, by a package bomb that had been sent to his home. And a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed 5 days before by a bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder. And I knew that I had opened a bomb. And there was a fire. And I tried to put it out, and I couldn't. And so went out in the hallway and hooked the fire alarm, and my neighbor came, said he had a fire extinguisher. And I went back in to call 911, and when I went to press the button for the 911 call, I realized that part of my right hand had been blown away. And then when I hung the phone up, it felt like somebody was trying to pull my trousers off my hips. And I looked down, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger as I looked at it. And my neighbor came and asked if there was anything else he could do, and asked him to give me a towel, and I opened my trousers, and I didn't have the courage to try to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been injured and put my back against the wall and slid down on the floor. And it was real evident to me, it was clear to me, I was dying. I was alone, and I was scared, and I was powerless. And Ken and Bob had been encouraging me to try to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wouldn't go in our town, but I would go up to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, or over to Frederick, Maryland, or down to Martinsburg, West Virginia. And I'd been to enough meetings to learn the Serenity Prayer, so the only tool I had to reach for was the Serenity Prayer, and I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing, which I couldn't change, and the courage to change what I could, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer. And God came. And I experienced a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I have never experienced before in my life, nor have I experienced it since. And I knew that if I died on that floor and never saw my wife or our three children again, it's going to be all right. Didn't know if I was going to live or die or not, but it's going to be all right. And so the police, fire, and rescue guys came in, and both my eardrums had been blown out, and I couldn't really hear what was being said, and I stopped praying to try to talk to them, and a tremendous wave of fear swept upon me, and so I told him, you guys just do whatever you got to do. And I went back to praying the Serenity Prayer. And as soon as I did, the serenity returned. And they cut all my clothes off of me and everything but my red and green Christmas socks. And they put me on a board and a gurney and took me down three flights of steps and stuffed me in an ambulance with my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the end. And they went around the world on CNN that night, and I went off to the hospital for surgery, and I don't know how shrapnel knows how to stop passing through flesh, but they removed what was described as a rather substantial piece of shrapnel that was not resting against but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And obviously if my femoral artery had been nicked, that would have been that. So they sent me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, Bob was at the foot of my bed, and he was smiling, and it's really good to have a sponsor. It is really good to have a sponsor, because sponsors just have a different take on stuff. They just see things differently. They really do. And he was smiling. I said, Bob, I notice you're smiling. What are you smiling about? And he said, well, I just think it must be wonderful, Jack, to know that you can't be harmed. I said, Bob, somebody just tried to kill me. Oh, he said, I understand that, Jack. He said, I understand that package you opened contained 4 pipe bombs. 1 pipe bomb's more than adequate to kill a human being. 2 pipe bombs, that's a little redundant. 3 pipe bombs, that's a bit around the bend. 4 pipe bombs, Jack, you have made somebody very angry. He said, man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God. He said, God has work for you. I said, oh, really, Bob? What kind of work does God have for me? So I wouldn't presume to know what's God's will in your life, Jack, but he said, I do know that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either me or Ken. You're going to have to do that 4-step inventory, do that 5th step with either Ken or I. Make that 6-step decision, pray that 7-step prayer, make that 8-step list. Begin making those 9-step amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12 and be of maximum service to God and to your fellow man. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't come up with that in a million years. You know, I think I left that hospital on Christmas Day 1989. It was the best Christmas I'd ever had. And I was the other day I was reminded that when I was drinking, the period from middle of November to the middle of January, I just drank and drank and drank and drank. Those were the worst 60 days of the year for me. And when I stopped drinking and didn't change during that period of 60 days, every year I fell into the dankest, darkest, deepest depression that I'd ever experienced in my life. And I walked out of that hospital on Christmas Day, 1989, and it was the best Christmas I'd ever had. And the following Christmas, my wife and I reconciled, and we've been together ever since. And if I don't screw this thing up, come August, we'll be married 42 years. And if she were here, you'd probably want to give her a chip for that. But so I started doing the deal. Now, I don't recommend getting blown up for a learning experience. I really don't. But it will tend to get you to focus on what's important. And my guess is that everybody in this room has had a bomb of one kind or another go off in your life. I think we call it pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I think that's what we call it. I really enjoyed listening to and seeing Chuck talk about the spiritual principles of this program. I'm retired as a circuit court judge because of the injuries I received in that bombing. And I've been practicing law for maybe, I guess, 15 years now, solo. I only represent the people that God sends to me. I try to apply the principles of this program to my private practice of law. I represent primarily alcoholics and drug addicts who still have money. So it's a... It's kind of a narrow, boutique kind of a practice, but it never ceases to amaze me, the people God sends to me. I am absolutely satisfied that what Chuck said in that film is absolutely correct. The practice of law became really, really easy for me when I applied the principles of this program to my daily life. I've had opportunities in Alcoholics Anonymous since I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to do amazing, wonderful, incredible things. and both in and out of the program. And, you know, how do you fit AA into your life, Jack? You're busy. How do you fit it in? I don't fit it in. AA is my life. It's because of AA that I get to do the other things that I get to do in and out of AA. We were talking at lunch today about a guy. 20 years ago, I sentenced him to 3 years in prison. But I didn't let him take him out of the courthouse. They held him in the holding area for 5 or 6 hours. And we brought him back into court, and he had 3 DWIs. And, you know, I suspended most of the sentence. And he said his last drink had been on Columbus Day. And I said, well, on Columbus Day, Columbus discovered a new world. Maybe you'll discover a new way of life. And I sentenced him to 3 AA meetings a week for 5 years as part of his probation. And he did that. And then when he got off of probation, he started doing 5 AA meetings a week just to show me. And 3 years ago, I was told I had to have open heart surgery. And the day before I was to go for open heart surgery, John called me. And I've never spoken to John on the telephone in my life. What do you want, John? He says, well, you know, Nancy and I are engaged. I said, yeah, I'd heard that. So we're going to get married on July the 5th. That's wonderful. He said, we've been praying about who I should ask to be my best man. He's got 3 adult boys. His dad was living with them. He said, we've decided to ask the person who has had the most profound impact on my life. I said, well, who's that, John? He said, it's you, Jack. Will you be my best man? When I sentenced that guy to 3 years in prison, he wasn't thinking about me being his best man. And neither was I. You know, people ask me how I'm doing today. I tell them I'm happy, joyous, and free today. But I think it's going to get better. And I say that because that's my experience. And if you're here tonight and you're not happy, joyous, and free, you need to talk to your sponsor. Because there's something you're not doing that you ought to be doing. Or there's something you're doing that you shouldn't be doing. Because as Chuck said and Sandy underscored, there is a conscious separation from God in this program if you're not happy, joyous, and free. Our book says, and my experience confirms, that happy, joyous, and free is promised to each and every one of us. I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody prayed. I know my wife prayed. I know my kids prayed. A lot of somebody's prayed. And you're here in Alcoholics Anonymous, because somebody prayed. And you may not like that, and you may not believe that. And AA doesn't care. It's truth. We're here as a result of prayer. I look at this room full of people and think about the journeys that all of our lives had to take to bring us here to this point in time. You know, there's some people here who weren't planning on coming. I know that. And there's some people who have been sent here to hear something, and I don't know what it was they were sent here to hear. Maybe it was something earlier today. Maybe it was something around the fire ring. Maybe it's what's going to be said tomorrow. I don't know. But I know that many of us have been sent here to hear something. And our book says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here, right now. There's a book that's already been mentioned that Eckhart Tolle wrote called The Power of Now. It's our program rewritten for those of us that don't understand the big book or don't care to read it. There's a guy named Joel Osteen down in Texas. They tell me he has the largest church in America. He wrote a book, bestseller, New York Times, Your Best Life Now. In our book it says that our purpose for living is to be of maximum service to God and to our fellow man. There's a guy named Rick Warren wrote a book called The Purpose-Driven Life. We don't have to buy those books. We're welcome to read them after we have a firm foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing wrong with those books. But if we're firmly rooted in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you will recognize our program in those books. If you are not firmly rooted in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are things in those books that may work very well for other people, don't work for alcoholics. I started my day this morning with prayer and meditation, because the big book tells me so. I'm not good at it. Most days I don't like it, at least when I start. But our book says, and my experience confirms, I can take my mind to a different thought plane. I didn't know that was possible, but my experience confirms it. I used to think if I got up on the wrong side of the bed, it was going to be one of those days. Now I know all I have to do is sit quietly, pray the prayers, reflect upon them, do what the book says. So now I have choices in my life. I can do what I want to do and suffer the consequences of that. I have warehouses full of evidence that that doesn't work, and I have an ego that says today may be the day. And then I've got a book that says, come along with us, Jack, follow our directions, and live happy, joyous, and free. Let's see. Egocentric misery, happy, joyous, and free. What's my choice going to be? And we debate that for a while. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it'd be nice to run your life today, Jack. Well, yeah, Jack, but you know it's going to crash and burn. Alcoholics are the only people that I know that treat loneliness with isolation. I cut myself off from the very thing that's helping me. Man, was that meeting great? Was that a great meeting we went to? Oh, yeah, it was terrific. You going to be back here next week? No, I'm too busy. I'll cut myself off from the very thing that's saving my life. My ego will do that. So, you know, what an honor to be here with you gentlemen and one lady. What a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. What a blessing to be able to live happy, joyous, and free. Thank you for letting me share.